from the Menasher. So let's, Mayan is a futuristic place and has always been a very feminine shul, where the energy is on the women's side. So I would recommend that we really get this class pumping and growing. And I'm going to haul more lunch for Ezra session. That's my commitment. And that's right. We have both teachers here today. So it's wonderful. And that's why I'm not letting anybody talk and I'm talking. Okay. Be well, everyone. It should be a gebench to other and I'm very happy for him. And only the best. We should have Mashiach today.
So we're a week, less than a week out from Purim. So we have to talk about Purim. So the first class that we did last year, Hindi taught the first class and then I taught the second class. And we started doing a series on Purim. So we already discussed last year a whole bunch of awesome Purim ideas. But we're going to revisit some of them again today because a whole year has passed. So we all have new levels of understanding into the depths. Actually, I think the Hasidus on Purim is some of like the deepest Hasidus that there is. It's just like really Purim is really the core essence of reality. That's what Purim is and expresses. So we can always go deeper into these ideas. We can always relearn them and remind ourselves of them. But before we go plunging a little bit deeper, I was just thinking because, so in Ohel Chana, I teach 12th grade. We have, it's officially their psychology class, but it's more about a class about like really cultivating resiliency and understanding our inner selves a little bit. And yesterday, the class that I was teaching, we were talking about influencing our emotions, right? That our emotions, what are emotions? Emotions are a response to a circumstance, right? Something happens and then our initial response, that's generally our emotional response. Our emotions are that initial response. And they seem to be quite impulsive and out of our control. But as we're learning in the Tanya class and Hasidus teaches, Zayar teaches, and modern psychology will teach, is that there is our brains have a level of control, our thought processes have a level of control over our emotions. So if, like my father was saying a few minutes ago, right, like last Adar, especially around here, was really heavy and not necessarily so, didn't feel so happy. And even now, like you could talk about world events for the Jewish people, doesn't feel very Adar-like. And I feel like this happens a lot. Like Adar comes and not such good things happen sometimes. And it's supposed to be Mishnechmas Adar Marbim Simcha. So on a very like practical level, when things are feeling very heavy, how do we increase in joy? How do we increase in joy when things feel very heavy? And the key is really in our heads. We have to, so you have your initial emotional response to something, right? Like that's like a little bit harder to control, your initial emotional response, right? But we can set ourselves up beforehand by training our thoughts and directing our thoughts in a certain direction so that our emotional response is more likely to be one that is positive, right? We all know like, oh, what kind of, if I'm thinking in a certain direction, I end up having negative emotions. If I think about how overworked I am and how everyone takes me for granted and other people have much easier lives than me, et cetera, then when something happens, what's gonna happen? When anything like slightly negative or that is, I don't understand why it's happening, it is happening, I'm gonna have a frustrated response, an angry response, right? When I have a more gratitude-centric thought process. And this takes a lot of work of like directing my mind in a certain way where I wake up and I'm like, it's other, right? I am increasing in joy. And taking a few minutes to focus on which thought processes increase my joy. But sometimes even, you know, working backwards, right? Like thinking about, oh, when I'm happy, what kind of state of mind was I when I was happy? And kind of trying to, I guess, just like locate those things and highlight those things that do make me happy and put my mind towards that in order to increase my joy. So that was just opening up with something super practical, because we're going to go a little deep. Hopefully we'll bring it back to practical at the end, but start with something a little more practical, like just like literally, if I want to increase in joy, if I want this to be a joyous month, then my mind needs to focus on the joy and find the joy, and my thoughts need to be in a positive direction, and then I will have joy, regardless of the circumstances, right? Even if they're hard, yes, there might be a moment of pain, but my general direction is in the direction of joy. Okay, putting that aside. Okay, so we're going into back into the Purim story. So I guess you could say like the main character of the Purim story is the one whose name is probably mentioned more than anyone else is King Ahasuerus, right? Hamelech this and Hamelech that. So he is our main character. I believe some people actually do even have a custom to open up the reading of the Megillah by saying Hamelech, like, and then starting reading the Megillah, because he is the main character of the Megillah and very prominent. But it's a very interesting thing about King Ahasuerus. He's the main character. He's officially in charge, but he's extremely passive in reality, right? Is he making any of his decisions really for himself? Most of the time, he's not. Most of the time, he's listening to advice from other people. He doesn't come across as a strong person. He is incredibly strong and powerful because he technically has all the power of this immense kingdom that basically is all of the civilized world at that time. But he doesn't really assert his power in a very strong way. He's, you know, constantly listening to advice. He's sort of being manipulated. And even at the end of the day, when it comes to him recognizing the story that played out, right? He says, oh, I already put my seal on it. I can't take back the decree anymore, but you guys can fight back, right? So you see his power almost seems not so strong. He's very passive throughout the story. So it's an interesting, he's a very interesting character, if you want to do a character analysis of King Ahasuerus. And it gets a little bit more interesting when we learn that, obviously Hashem's name is not mentioned anywhere in the Megillah, which is a question that was answered and asked and answered by many, but Hashem's name is not referenced in the Megillah. But the Zayar says, and there are a number of sources that explain that when it's talking about Hamelech, who else is it talking about? Hashem. Oh, so it's talking about Ahasuerus, obviously. He's the king, but it's also referring to Hamelech, the king, which is Hashem. But that makes it even a little bit stranger because, like we said before, he's not a very strong character. He's very passive. It's an interesting thing to say that this is Hashem. So in order to understand why this Hamelech is Hashem, we're going to talk about in general God's role as a king. In davening of Yamim Ne'eram, right, we refer to Hashem as many different relationships towards us. So we refer to Hashem as our father, our king, our master, there's even like a husband and wife relationship that's referred to. Like there's all these different levels of our relationship with God, right? When it comes to Hashem being a melech, this is a very interesting thing. Melech, the relationship of king and subject is a relationship that is basically entirely dependent on distance. There needs to be distance for there to be a relationship between a king and his subjects. And this is talking about like real kingship. We're not talking about leadership today. I think on a certain level, what we want from our leaders today is accessibility and relate, and we want them to be relatable to us, right? We enjoy when our leaders feel like, oh, they're just another person, right? But from that level of the leader being relatable to us, what happens to the leader? The very relatable leader, he might have a great, very great power of influence, right? But he doesn't actually have like absolute power, like the distant king, because he's too close, right? For there to be this like stamp of power, of malchus, I am the king, you are the subject, there needs to be this distance, or at least an illusion of distance. That's why the king is not easily accessible. If the king is too easily accessible, he loses his power. And I think it's something that we struggle with a lot in different leadership positions, whether it's in any sort of like position of authority, whether it's in parenting or being a teacher or relating to youth. It's like, we all want to be like so accessible and close and cool. And then what happens to the authority? It becomes a little bit, it starts to slip away. So the question is how you sort of anchor both together, but that's a discussion for a different time. But just in general, this idea of malthus is that it's reliant on this distance. So the king is in the capital city, in his palace, behind, maybe there's even a moat, you know, behind lots of walls. We have guards. And to get into the king, you're going through multiple levels of guards, right? The guards at the front door, the guards at the inside the palace, and then finally before his chambers. You have to go through all these layers and layers of guards. You have to be granted an audience. And so the king is far. And that's what we say, we emphasize like during Elul, the king is in the field. Because, oh, hey, the king element is all of a sudden close, which he usually isn't. The king, Hashem, the element of kingship is a level of distance. Now, when it comes to a human king, the level of distance on a certain level, on a certain plane of reality, the level of distance of the human king is actually not that real. Because the human king, right, it says Paro hid when he went to the bathroom, right? He didn't want people to know that he went to the bathroom. What is this telling us, right? That the human king, he goes to the bathroom, right? He sleeps. He does all the other things that a human being does. And he is as limited as the rest of human beings are. He maybe has more access to resources, but, you know, physically, he is just a person. And he's finite. So his distance, a lot of what the king, a lot of all the purpose, the pomp and circumstance that surrounds the king is to create an illusion of distance. But the distance is not so true and real. When it comes to Hashem, however, Hashem is, on a certain level, ultimately distant from us. Because, I don't want to say Hashem doesn't go to the bathroom, like it's silly, but like Hashem is not, he's not relatable to us in any way. Hashem is not commensurate to us. There's no level of comparison between God and the world, God and human beings, right? He is utterly and absolutely distant from us on a certain level. Right, so on some level, Hashem is utterly and absolutely distant from us. And from this place comes the element of kingship, comes the element of being the king over the people. And when the Zohar talks about this and the Arizal talks about this, when Kabbalah describes the beginning of Hashem deciding to be a king over the world, right, because the king needs subjects. That's why the world, that's Hashem put himself into the role of kings to create a world, because having an other is a king is only worthwhile if there's an other, right? So to enter into the role of Melech, Hashem created a world. But before he created a world, there was first the tzimtzum. First there's the hiding. First there's the concealment. Because the king needs this element of distance, right? And when there's revelation, what do we feel? We feel close. When there's darkness, that's when we notice the distance from Hashem. But this darkness, the darkness that Hashem created in order to create the world, is still for the sake of creating the world. It's not for the sake of just darkness. It's for the sake of creating the world. I saw a line in an article by Rabbi Eli Rubin, who writes on Chabad.org, but he just put it so well, so I wrote it down. He writes, the illusion of kingship is the substance from which the concrete reality is built. I'm going to say it again, because it's very deep. It's really good. The illusion of kingship, right? Hashem creates this illusion of darkness. So you might say, oh, it's just an illusion, so it's not... What actually is going on over here? What's real? But this illusion of kingship is the substance from which the concrete reality is built. Through this darkness, the darkness is almost like the building blocks for the world, right? It becomes what Hashem uses to create a real world. And that's what's necessary to create a real world, is this element of darkness is absolutely vital to create a real world. So if we go, again, I said we're going deep today, but bear with me. If we go back to pre-creation, right? Before God created the world. Before Hashem created the world existed in potential within Hashem, right? Because everything, Hashem is not nothing, Hashem is everything, right? So the possibility for world existed within God, because if there can be a world, that means it exists within God, because he's everything. Make sense what I said? It's hard, right? But the possibility, the potential for world existed within Hashem, right? But what was the reality on the outside? What existed? Only him, and only his light, and only his splendor. Hashem himself only existed externally. When Hashem created the world, there was a vina hafechu, right? There was an absolute turning upside down of reality, a complete flipping over of what's going on. That which existed in potential became the reality, right? So the world became our, what you might say, lived experience, how we perceive reality. And what becomes sort of potential in the world? God's light, right? So the world exists. And if you want, you can dig into the world and you can peel the layers of reality back, and you will uncover godliness if you're looking for it, right? But that's something you have to look for. It's there in almost, it's there in reality, but it's there in a state of potential. We need, on our part, we need to uncover it, right? So we have this complete reversal of what we would call Yechudei Ila and Yechudei Tata, right? Yechudei Ila is the higher level of Hashem's unity, is the reality that only God exists and the world is just in potential, right? That's Yechudei Ila, it's a higher level of unity. The lower level of unity is that everything within everything in this world, you can find God, right? And that flip, at least from our human perspective, happens with the creation of the world, is that the world exists, but within everything we can find God, right? So there's still absolute unity, but I need to seek it out, right? It's that's become sort of our job. Okay, so I'm just gonna like recap what we've said until now. So we said Malchus is this level of distance. It's this level of darkness that God creates, right? It's this illusion of darkness that Hashem creates, because there needs to be this darkness for him to be able to be ruler over the world. If there wasn't this darkness, then God would not be able to be ruler over creation. If there wasn't this darkness, the whole world would think that it's still within Hashem. We all wouldn't feel independent. We wouldn't feel like our own people. We would just feel like we are part of God, right? We would feel like we are just completely united with Hashem. So Hashem creates this darkness. There's this vina hafechu. The world becomes reality to us. Godliness becomes potential to us. And our shift becomes that we need to find the godliness in the potential godliness in the darkness, in this malchus of the world, right? In this distance, we're finding the king. We're seeking him out. So in the Megillah, there's a mimer that we discussed last year, actually, in Para R, that talks about how when the king wakes up in the middle of the night and he's bothered, he remembers that Mordecai did him a favor and he was never repaid, right? So he tells, and then he finds Haman in the courtyard. He's wandering around because he's excited. He has his scheme to kill Mordecai. And he goes to the king, and the king says, "What should I do to someone that I wish to honor?" And Haman, thinking that he's talking about himself, right? Because he's maybe slightly narcissistic. And to him, this power-hungry person, what does he want? What is his ultimate goal? To be the king. So he says, dress him up like the king, parade him around through town for the day. So it says, Yaviu levosh malchus, put him in the cloak of malchus. So from these words, the Alter Rebbe extrapolates a whole idea that in general, the cloak, malchus, is defined by the cloak, the king's robe, right? And it's very interesting because the king's robe, what does it do? What does the robe do? It hides the shape of the king, right? But at the same time, it also declares who the king is. In general, that's like the role of clothing. It hides us because it conceals our bodies. But on another level, our clothes are extremely expressive, right? And they express a very deep part of us. So why is it that hiding and darkness end up being revelation? How can hiding and darkness end up being revelation? So on this level, this is something that some of the rabbin have some quotes about, but on this level, the atheist has it right a little bit, right? What does the atheist say? Look at this physical world. This physical world could not have evolved from something spiritual. There must have been, it's an extremely physical place. There must have been some sort of physical trigger to this world, right? So you can go all the way back to the whichever cause you want to go back to, whether it's the Big Bang or pre the Big Bang even. You can go all the way to in cosmology, study it if you wish at your own risk, but you can go back to try to find the primordial first cause of physicality. Because how can physicality come from something spiritual, right? How can physicality come from something spiritual? It makes no sense. And on that level, the atheist is right. Physicality does not come from something spiritual because Hashem is not spiritual. So if you think of God as something spiritual, something transcendent, something totally like not concrete, then yes, he cannot create a concrete world. Hashem is not spiritual. And that's the saying that, you know, the God that you don't believe in, I don't believe in either, right? Because if you're thinking of a God, again, as this transcendent spiritual being, that is not the God of the Torah. That is not the God that we are referring to. Hashem is not spiritual. Spirituality is a creation the same way physicality is a creation. Hashem created immense spirituality, right? Even whenever we're talking about all of Hashem's great light, right? We talk about Hashem's light. We talk about Hashem's chachma. We talk about Hashem's chesed, right? These are all spiritual creations of Hashem. But Hashem is not his chachma. The same way I am not my chachma, right? I am not just my thoughts. My thoughts greatly influence how I behave and how I interact with other people and how people perceive me, but I am not my thoughts. I am so much more than my thoughts, right? And Hashem is not his thoughts. Hashem is not his created spirit. Hashem is not his created light. And this is the mila of darkness. What happens if the world is filled with light? If the world is filled with light and the light of Hashem, what happens to the people is that they think that they have access to God himself, right? They think they have access to God himself because they're constantly in a state of godly revelation. But what are they actually accessing? Just godly revelation, right? So they don't have access to God himself. So sometimes the revelation almost acts as a barrier to reaching the true self. And this can happen even like in human relationships sometimes, right? You can have someone who's like very articulate and very good at expressing themselves and very open to sharing, right? And so they'll share a lot of parts of themselves and other people will think, oh, I understand them completely, right? Because they're so expressive and they're sharing things. Meanwhile, something can be going on deeper inside of them that you have know nothing about. And there's never like that trigger to try to get to know what's going on over here. If you have, let's say, a kid that, you know, comes home from school and talks all about their day and whatever, and everything sounds so nice. So the parent's never going to go and investigate if anything else is going on in school, how the kid is really feeling or whatever. The kid who comes home from school and refuses to say anything. Nope, I'm not going to tell you how my day was, right? Or refusing to respond. What's going to happen? It's going to send a trigger to the parent, right? In a sense, what's this darkness doing? The fact that the child's staying quiet. The darkness is sending a trigger to the parent. Hey, I need to investigate what's actually going on with this kid, right? I need to see what's really in his mind or her mind. Sometimes the darkness basically sends us a signal that I'm not grasping the entire being over here. I'm not grasping the entire essence. And this is why it says that when Mashiach comes, this is what we discussed last year at length, when Mashiach comes, all other holidays are going to be nullified except for Purim. So what does it mean that all other holidays are going to be nullified? Isn't like the whole point of Mashiach bringing Karbanos and the Beis HaMikdash on Shalosh Regalim, all these like amazing, exciting things? So it's explained in Hasidus that it's not that all the holidays are actually not going to exist. It's just that when Mashiach comes, Hashem's essence is going to be revealed. God himself is going to be apparent and obvious to everyone. Okay? What are holidays? What is a yontif? A yontif is a revelation of Hashem's light. On Pesach, we have the revelation of Hashem's power of freedom, right? And therefore, we're all able to tap into the power of freedom. On Sukkot, maybe you could say the revelation of joy. There's different energies, right, that are revealed over in each holiday. When you have access to the person themselves, do you need their light? Right? When you're having a moment of true connection with the person, do you need to talk? Not really, right? When you're attaching essence to essence, words aren't necessary. Words are almost cheap in that kind of scenario because words are only an expression of the self. It's not the self itself, right? So when we're connecting to essence, essence is the truest nothingness that there is. That's what essence is. What do we mean by the truest nothingness? We talk, we express. Why do we express? Because we have to prove, in a way, our expression is the proof of our existence, right? When we express ourselves, we're saying, I exist, I'm here. Essence exists in such a real way that it doesn't need to prove itself. That's why it's quiet. That's why it's dark. It just is. It doesn't need to prove itself. It doesn't need to express itself to show that I am here. It just is here. And that's why we say like that. And so that's the mila of darkness is this power of it's dark, but the thing is here in such a real and absolute way. So like we said before, when Mashiach comes, Hashem's reality is just real, but we're going to flip back to the old model of like God being the reality. So when the light of the Yom Tovim come, we'll still commemorate the holiday, but the light is not adding anything because we're in the state of essence. Which holiday is not going to be nullified? What do we say is Purim. Why? Because Purim is darkness, not light. Purim is just the omnipresence of God. Right, HaMelech in the story, he's everywhere. He's popping up all the time. Does he look glamorous? Like he's not showing himself as being this strong, powerful king. There's no great display of miracles. He's just totally present throughout the story. And you see it also, like if you would take the story of Purim and you would just live it out over the course. I think it was 9 years from beginning to end. Not sure, but I believe something. 13? I've seen a number of different midrashim that say, you know, how long. But it wasn't, we read it in half an hour, if you have a good vocabulary, right? So we read it in a half an hour. So when any person's life, right, any person's life, if you took 10, 13 years of your life, and you just took like key elements of things that like, were really transformative and created your reality now, and you compacted them into a 30-minute story. We'd all have, I think, pretty cool things going on, right? We'd all have a good story. That's what the whole memoir business is, right? You take your life, you compact it into a book, you put it in quickly, you choose all the cool cause and effect things that happen, and you have a cool story, right? That's what the Megillah is. It's 9 years. If you stretched it out and you lived it, it was just politics. It was just regular life going on, and one thing happened that was hard, and we didn't know how we were going to deal with it, and another thing happened that was hard, and something happened that was good, and she ended up here and he ended up there. Right? Like that's literally what the Purim story is. There's no grand display. There's no splitting of the sea. There's no seeing the sounds and hearing the sights of Mothantara. There's no crazy transformation of like miracles that are happening that are taking us completely and totally out of nature. So on that level, it's darkness, right? But in the darkness, what's there all the time? God's truest nothingness, right? Hashem's truest essence, and we're not distracted by revelations. We're not distracted by miracles. We're not distracted by glamour and glitz and light, and we're able to get to what the core is, and the core is God. What?
Or you see nothing.
So that's the work.
What's the world?
Right. So that's the work, but that's the point. You can't just, the reason the darkness is necessary is to force us, like we said before, right? We're in the state where everything is v'nahapichut, it's switched, right? So God's unity still exists absolutely in the same way as it did before Hashem created the world, right? The world is, nothing changed, right? We say that like Hashem is the same before the world was created and after the world was created. There is no difference. A person can go through their entire life and not see God at all, ever, right? That's possible in this world. It's possible to live your entire life and never, ever seek out God. Might be sad, but it's possible. Many people do it, right? There are many Jewish people who do it, unfortunately. Many firm people who do it too, right? Where you're not seeking out Hashem himself. We're maybe living life in a religious way, but we don't understand why we're doing it. We're not seeking a truth. This is a lifestyle. It's a culture, right? Sometimes it takes like a little bit of like this darkness to jolt us into, I need to see more. I need to probe out what the truth is over here. And it's very difficult and it's very hard. And it can't be understood, right? What we're trying to find right here is not something that we're going to find with our minds. Because if you're finding it with your mind and you're understanding it, that means that it's still within the realm of revelation, right? If I can understand it, it's in the realm of revelation. So it's not going to happen in my mind. It's going to happen specifically it happens through action. That's how we really uncover the true essence of Hashem. But it's going to be an experience, not an intellectual thing. It's going to be something I experience where I have this like essential bond with Hashem. And whether it's something I realize in a like a very obvious way, or like you said before, it's something that's so subtle. When Mashiach comes, that's what the reality of Mashiach is, Purim revealed. That's what Mashiach is. Like, that's what we said. Purim is still going to exist when Mashiach comes, because the reality of Mashiach is Purim revealed. It's Purim taking away the cloak, taking away the darkness, and revealing just the essence. So we don't need, when Mashiach comes, we don't need the darkness to get to the essence. During Galus, we still have this darkness that is pushing us to get to the essence. And then it's like all Mashiach is, it's just lifting off this cloak of darkness, and the essence is all here. And we're seeing, oh, it was here the whole time. Right. And so I think that like we even opened up with the fact that sometimes we're feeling the darkness of Galus in an extra special way. I mean, I think Jews always did, but for us personally, it feels extra special and hard and dark. Right. And we're not saying we're not glorifying the darkness, not romanticizing the darkness. There's nothing romantic about it, but there is still truth within it, right? And it's not purposeless. It's to drive us to uncovering the truth of reality and uncovering the truth of Hashem without any distractions and glamour. And on that note, I would give it over to the people to bring about it, or whatever you want to bring about. There you go. Yeah, sure. What?
You said the king cannot
be darkness. So the point is that the relationship and the nature of a king is that we need to, especially in the realm of understanding what a king is. A king, especially in the days of Ahasuerus, or in the days of true kingship, he has ultimate authority, right? Ultimate authority. can someone who seems just like you have ultimate authority? No, right? What creates, what allows for that authority is this distance, right? And so kings really tried to maintain that. That was a huge part of, is like this illusion of distance, because the distance is what grants this authority and creates this whole relationship between the king and the subject. As soon as the king becomes too close, he's no longer the king.
Most of the time,
yeah. Right, but again, the king can go out into the field sometimes, makes himself accessible to create some sort of relationship sometimes, but all at the same time, there's always, first you have to create that illusion of distance and death. So darkness means, well, darkness is the distance. The fact, if Hashem is close and revealed, right? If Hashem is close and revealed and obvious, then there isn't that there isn't this separation to have him as a king over the world.
I understand that. You're calling
separation darkness. Yeah, in this case, we're calling it separation darkness. It's a symptom. It's the lack of revelation would be darkness, right? Lack of light is dark. And you could say, I'll put it this way, it doesn't even have to be pain and suffering.
Right.
Saying it's pain, darkness is not just pain and suffering. Darkness is the fact that I can deny Hashem, that I don't see, that is itself is darkness, right? We think we only, like, in our own minds, we only see it and experience when we have something hard, but just the fact that I can go through regular life, let's say nothing bad is happening, but I could just live, yeah.
Talking about a king.
With the king, you wouldn't call it darkness. You would use the word distance. Yeah. Right. It's just that it's just opening our door to understanding how could Hashem be Melech without being, obviously present or showing like cool displays of power. That's what we usually associate with God in his full glory, instead of just the king that's always there, but not necessarily showing how he's manipulating the story or how he's pulling the strings, right? Yeah. We're not saying Hashem's strings are being pulled, but we're saying that Hashem is taking a more passive role, stepping back to allow us to find himself. Right? Yes. I'm not qualified to answer this question. I don't know what it's going to be like when Mashiach comes. But on a basic level, you would think on some level of higher, there are different kufis. There are different periods of Mashiach and like how this transformation of the entire world is going to take place. So you can say that in its ultimate state of Mashiach, there are no hierarchies because it's very essential. But until we get there, there might still, I don't know. Yeah, exactly. There we go. Yeah. Yeah, what was the question?
I just, the way the king Hashem is to us today is that he's unaccessible. Technically, we don't have a conversation of the king.
Right.
Although, I guess I'm a tiny bit confused because we're taught to understand that he's here with us every second. So I don't know if you're going to be.
So there are different relationships that we ascribe to God and the Jewish people all the time. And they're all happening simultaneously, right? So we call him Father or King, right? Right? Avinu Malkeinu. Father is very accessible, right? So there are different, you can say, energy points where Hashem is engaging with the world, right?
Ultimately,
he's everywhere and present, and his essence is everywhere and ultimately accessible on an essential level, whatever that means, right? And then there's even levels of expression where he's accessible to us, right? The more you cultivate the relationship, the closer you can feel the relationship with Hashem, right? And you can go on spirit. There are people who go on spiritual journeys and work on refining themselves and becoming more and more and more spiritual and really connecting to Hashem in such a spiritual way. But the point is that on that spiritual connection is still not necessarily touching the core of Hashem himself. Hashem himself is accessed actually primarily through action and through doing his mitzvahs and fulfilling his will. Like that's how when we get in touch with his core, his essence. You can say it's the difference between like, see, you're married, right? You can have your long conversations where you're talking and enjoying each other's time, right? That's one facet of the relationship. But then there's the fact that like, you got to pick up your socks and put them in the hamper and you have to, you know, we're going to be washing dishes. And these are really the building, like the foundations of the marriage, because if those don't happen and you only have long conversations, like the essential fabric of the relationship just falls apart. So it's really in all like the small little things that we do that we really connect essentially. And then we also have the beautiful conversations as well. But those aren't necessarily essential. That's us enjoying each other's company. Right? Thank you. Thank you.